Chapter 6 Miracle Metal.
But can we get away with it?
Asked Wesley Mooch. His voice was high with anger and thin with fear. Nobody answered him. James Taggart sat on the edge of an armchair, not moving, looking up at him from under his forehead. Orrin Boyle gave a vicious tap against an ashtray, shaking the ash off his cigar. Dr. Floyd Ferris smiled. Mr. Weatherby folded his lips and hands. Fred Kinnon, head of the Amalgamated Labor of America, stopped pacing the office, sat down on the windowsill and crossed his arms. Eugene Lawson, who had sat hunched downward, absent-mindedly rearranging a display of flowers on a low glass table, raised his torso resentfully and glanced up. Mooch sat at his desk, with his fist on a sheet of paper. It was Eugene Lawson who answered. That's not, it seems to me, the way to put it. We must not let vulgar difficulties obstruct our feeling that it's a noble plan motivated solely by the public welfare. It's for the good of the people. The people need it. Need comes first, so we don't have to consider anything else. Nobody objected or picked it up. They looked as if Lawson had merely made it harder to continue the discussion. But a small man who sat unobtrusively in the best armchair of the room apart from the others, content to be ignored and fully aware that none of them could be unconscious of his presence, glanced at Lawson, then at Mooch, and said with brisk cheerfulness, "That's the line, Wesley. Tone it down and dress it up, and get your press boys to chant it, and you won't have to worry." "Yes, Mr. Thompson," said Mooch glumly. Mr. Thompson, the head of the state, was a man who possessed the quality of never being noticed. In any group of three, his person became indistinguishable, and when seen alone, it seemed to evoke a group of its own, composed of the countless persons he resembled. The country had no clear image of what he looked like. His photographs had appeared on the covers of magazines as frequently as those of his predecessors in office, but people could never be quite certain which photographs were his and which were pictures of a mail clerk or a white-collar worker, accompanying articles about the daily life of the undifferentiated, except that Mr. Thompson's collars were usually wilted. He had broad shoulders and a slight body. He had stringy hair, a wide mouth, and an elastic age range that made him look like a harassed 40 or an unusually vigorous 60. Holding enormous official powers, he schemed ceaselessly to expand them, because it was expected of him by those who had pushed him into office. He had the cunning of the unintelligent and the frantic energy of the lazy. The sole secret of his rise in life was the fact that he was a product of chance and knew it and aspired to nothing else.
"It's obvious that measures have to be taken, drastic measures," said James Taggart, speaking not to Mr. Thompson but to Wesley Mooch. "We can't let things go the way they're going much longer."
His voice was belligerent and shaky. "Take it easy, Jim," said Orrin Boyle.
"Something's got to be done, and done fast." "Don't look at me," snapped Wesley Mooch. "I can't help it. I can't help it if people refuse to cooperate. I'm tired. I need wider powers."
Mooch had summoned them all to Washington as his friends and personal advisers for a private unofficial conference on the national crisis. But watching him, they were unable to decide whether his manner was overbearing or whining, whether he was threatening them or pleading for their help. "Fact is," said Mr. Weatherby primly, in a statistical tone of voice, "that in the 12-month period ending on the first of this year, the rate of business failures has doubled as compared with the preceding 12-month period. Since the first of this year, it has trebled."
"Be sure they think it's their own fault," said Dr. Ferris casually.
"Huh?"
said Wesley Mooch, his eyes darting to Ferris.
"Whatever you do, don't apologize," said Dr. Ferris. "Make them feel guilty."
"I'm not apologizing," snapped Mooch. "I'm not to blame. I need wider powers."
"But it is their own fault," said Eugene Lawson, turning aggressively to Dr. Ferris. "It's their lack of social spirit. They refuse to recognize that production is not a private choice but a public duty. They have no right to fail, no matter what conditions happen to come up. They've got to go on producing. It's a social imperative. A man's work is not a personal matter. It's a social matter. There's no such thing as a personal matter or a personal life. That's what we've got to force them to learn."
"Gene Lawson knows what I'm talking about," said Dr. Ferris with a slight smile, "even though he hasn't the faintest idea that he does."
"What do you think you mean?" said Lawson, his voice rising.
"Skip it,"
ordered Wesley Mooch. "I don't care what you decide to do, Wesley," said Mr. Thompson. "And I don't care if the businessmen squawk about it. Just be sure you've got the press with you. Be damn sure about that."
"I've got 'em," said Mooch.
"One editor who'd open his trap at the wrong time could do us more harm than 10 disgruntled millionaires."
"That's true, Mr. Thompson," said Dr. Ferris. "But can you name one editor who knows it?"
"Guess not," said Thompson. He sounded pleased.
"Whatever type of men we're counting on and planning for," said Dr. Ferris, "there's a certain old-fashioned quotation which we may safely forget, the one about counting on the wise and the honest. We don't have to consider them, they're out of date."
James Taggart glanced at the window. There were patches of blue in the sky above the spacious streets of Washington, the faint blue of mid-April, and a few beams breaking through the clouds. A monument stood shining in the distance, hit by a ray of sun. It was a tall white obelisk, erected to the memory of the man Dr. Ferris was quoting, the man in whose honor this city had been named. James Taggart looked away.
"I don't like the professor's remarks," said Lawson loudly and sullenly.
"Keep still," said Wesley Mooch.
"Dr. Ferris is not talking theory, but practice."
"Well, if you want to talk practice," said Fred Kinnon, "then let me tell you that we can't worry about businessmen at a time like this. What we've got to think about is jobs, more jobs for the people. In my unions, every man who's working is feeding 5 who aren't, not counting his own pack of starving relatives. If you want my advice, oh, I know you won't go for it, but it's just a thought. Issue a directive making it compulsory to add, say, 1/3 more men to every payroll in the country."
"Good God," yelled Taggart. "Are you crazy? We can barely meet our payrolls as it is. There's not enough work for the men we've got now. 1/3 more? We wouldn't have any use for them, whatever."
"Who cares whether you'd have any use for them?" said Fred Kinnon. "They need jobs. That's what comes first, need, doesn't it? Not your profits."
"It's not a question of profits," yelled Taggart hastily. "I haven't said anything about profits. I haven't given you any grounds to insult me. It's just a question of where in hell we'd get the money to pay your men when half our trains are running empty and there's not enough freight to fill a trolley car."
His voice slowed down suddenly to a tone of cautious thoughtfulness. "However, we do understand the plight of the working man, and it's just a thought. We could perhaps take on a certain extra number if we were permitted to double our freight rates, which..."
"Have you lost your mind?" yelled Orrin Boyle. "I'm going broke on the rates you're charging now. I shudder every time a damn boxcar pulls in or out of the mills. They're bleeding me to death. I can't afford it. And you want to double it?"
"It is not essential whether you can afford it or not," said Taggart coldly. "You have to be prepared to make some sacrifices. The public needs railroads. Need comes first. Above your profits."
"What profits?" yelled Orrin Boyle. "When did I ever make any profits? Nobody can accuse me of running a profit-making business. Just look at my balance sheet, and then look at the books of a certain competitor of mine who's got all the customers, all the raw materials, all the technical advantages, and a monopoly on secret formulas. Then tell me who's the profiteer. But of course the public does need railroads, and perhaps I could manage to absorb a certain raise in rates if I were to get, it's just a thought, if I were to get a subsidy to carry me over the next year or two until I catch my stride, and..."
"What, again?" yelled Mr. Weatherby, losing his primness. "How many loans have you got from us, and how many extensions, suspensions, and moratoriums? You haven't repaid a penny. And with all of you boys going broke and the tax receipts crashing, where do you expect us to get the money to hand you a subsidy?"
"There are people who aren't broke," said Boyle slowly. "You boys have no excuse for permitting all that need and misery to spread through the country, so long as there are people who aren't broke."
"I can't help it," yelled Wesley Mooch. "I can't do anything about it. I need wider powers."
They could not tell what had prompted Mr. Thompson to attend this particular conference. He had said little, but had listened with interest. It seemed as if there were something which he had wanted to learn, and now he looked as if he had learned it. He stood up and smiled cheerfully. "Go ahead, Wesley," he said. "Go ahead with number 10-289. You won't have any trouble at all." They had all risen to their feet in gloomy, reluctant deference. Wesley Mooch glanced down at his sheet of paper, then said in a petulant tone of voice,
"If you want me to go ahead,
You'll have to declare a state of total emergency. I'll declare it any time you're ready. There are certain difficulties, which I'll leave it up to you. Work it out any way you wish. It's your job. Let me see the rough draft tomorrow or next day, but don't bother me about the details. I've got a speech to make on the radio in half an hour.
The chief difficulty is that I'm not sure whether the law actually grants us the power to put into effect certain provisions of Directive Number 10-289. I fear they might be open to challenge.
Oh, hell, we've passed so many emergency laws that if you hunt through them, you're sure to dig up something that will cover it. Mr. Thompson turned to the others with a smile of good fellowship.
I'll leave you boys to iron out the wrinkles, he said. I appreciate you coming to Washington to help us out. Glad to have seen you.